This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Our national obsession with food, where it comes from, how it's grown, has led to a number of buzzworthy documentary films in recent years. Any respectable farmer's market shopper has seen Food, Inc. and can probably tell you the key points made in King Corn. New to the food documentary circuit this year is American Meat from filmmaker Graham Merriweather. He says his goal is to frame the arguments against our industrial agriculture system in terms that invite dialogue rather than debate. American Meat struck a chord with some folks in Saxapahoe, a place that's become a sustainable food mecca in Alamance County. Farmer Suzanne Nelson of Cozy Farms has organized a screening and panel discussion of the film at the Haw River Ballroom tomorrow night. She joins me now in the studio. Also with us are some of the other panelists. Eliza McLean owns Cane Creek Farm in Snow Camp, and Jeff Barney is the chef at Saxapahoe General Store and the Eddie Pub. And joining us is Graham Merriweather, the New York City-based filmmaker of American Meat. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks.
Suzanne, you saw American Meat when it premiered earlier this year, and you were determined to bring it to Saxapahoe. Why?
I think for two different reasons. One, I was really taken with Graham's work. I have a background in journalism, and to tell a story about something that you're passionate about in a way that doesn't turn into a polemic takes an extraordinary amount of journalistic discipline, and to let the voices in the story tell the story themselves. And I was really taken with how well he did that. And I also had a desire to share with Graham and with others that may not have been to Saxapahoe the ways in which I believe our little village has some answers to some of the things that the film puts up as questions.
Well, I want to play a bit of the film now. This is the introduction of American Meat. It's a woman called Jean Kilpatrick who recently began keeping chickens in her backyard, and she's talking about the difference between her chickens and those she buys from the store.
We got the chickens as little tiny baby chicks. We kept them inside for the first month of their lives. Chickens at the grocery store are mass-produced. I never have to deal with those chickens at all. I don't have to watch them grow. I don't have to feed them.
Yeah, and the narrator goes on to finish her thought and says she doesn't have to kill them either. Suzanne, what was it about that woman's comments that struck you?
The disconnect between this sort of backyard chicken coop that she had, where these chickens took on personalities and were almost pet-like to her. She had names for them, I believe. And then the nameless, faceless chicken on her plate. And the sort of lack of irony that whole thing was taken with. I see that a lot. A lot of our customers have backyard chickens, and we have helped provide them with a locally milled organic feed. And so I have this conversation with them a lot because at some point a hen stops laying very well. And that's not too far into her life. When she's about two or three, she no longer pays her own feed bill. And so you're left with a hen who consumes quite a bit of expensive feed and doesn't pay you back. And a lot of these folks are then at this conundrum that, oh my gosh, this is Flopsy. What now? And so that was a thing that I've had to come to myself as a farmer, as a person, as an eater. Is I used to only kill chickens in the dark because that was the only time I could deal with it. And so I would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go outside and harvest roosters that were making trouble. And if that sun started to crack, I went back in and waited till the next day. And so it's something that I really personally understand, but I also understand that the way in which livestock can be an incredible healing mechanism for our landscape and for our economies. And so it was something that I pushed myself to go beyond. And I think it's one of the important questions the film asks, that if we care about these animals in the context of our backyard chicken coop, then how can we better care for the chickens that we're putting on our plates?
And that's the ethical question, which is a serious one and one that is up for debate. How do we and in what way do we kill to eat? Because as Joseph Campbell said, the vegetarian fails to hear the scream of the carrot. I mean, one way or another, something has to die for us to be here. How do we do that? And that becomes an interesting part of this discussion.
Or the bunnies that were decapitated with the combine, or the deer that are being completely taken off of the fields in California and other places through these really really strict vegetable safety guidelines for how our vegetables are raised, that no animals can be, including wild animals, bunnies, anything, they're not welcome on these farms where we're raising carrots. And that is such an historically abnormal concept that we would have that separation. And that separation means an extraordinary amount of death.
And that, as I say, is part of the ethical question that's raised in the film. Jeff, the other one is the scalability of this. If we accept that sustainable farming is better than industrial farming, then the question is, well, yeah, but how big can it get? Can it feed us all? And in the past few years, the Saxipahaw community, I think, has become an example of a kind of viable system, a network of food that include sustainable food, and you're part of that. Tell us about the Saxipahaw General Store and how that fits into all this.
Well, it's part of our mission to promote and be involved in the local economy, keeping our dollars local. And the local food shed is a major portion of that, which has also ecological implications. So when we started with the store, it was a convenience store. We still sell gas. We've added a biodiesel pump from Piedmont Biofuels. We slowly changed from a frozen pizza, hot dog roller convenience store to providing local foods. Put the word out with a street sign to begin with that we wanted local eggs, local produce. I had been at the Chatham Marketplace Co-op, helped start that food endeavor and met a lot of farmers and was able to sort of bring relationships like with Eliza from that, from Pittsburgh. And slowly it has become, in the spirit of collaboration, a tighter and tighter network of local food sheds.
Well, then, Eliza, you've been at this. You and your Asabaw hogs have been feeding the Piedmont for quite a while now. How have things changed in recent years for the market in terms of, you know, getting into the business and being sustainable as a farmer for you?
Meaning just more people involved?
Yeah, the market. Because is it easier to do this business now or and sell your product to stay in business?
I think so. The demand has increased as we expected that it would, and I'm glad that it has. And more farmers have come into the area. More and more people are actually producing more than just for their families on their smaller pieces of land. And Jeff is a great aggregator of those people, too, those that don't do the farmer's market like I do. And more farmer's markets, of course, have come up in the last few years. I mean, it's I don't think it's saturated, but you have to keep your eye on the ball to stay in this business. It's still not easy. I mean, none of us would do it if we didn't feel some immense pride in it, because you can't work this hard and make this little money unless you love every moment of it, pretty much. But I remember talking to you 4 years ago and talking about the critical mass thing. We're getting there. I don't even think we're yet there. There's still lots and lots of consumers that need to be brought into it, and more and room for more producers. But we need to collaborate.
And Graham, that's one of the things that you took on in the film, is the scalability of this, because one of the critiques of sustainable farming is, yeah, it's nice for those folks who, A, can afford it, and B, kind of show up at the farmer's market and lollygag around. But honestly, you're not going to feed America with grass-fed animals. And in your film, you have found that, yeah, you can. Tell us more about that.
Sure. It's a big question, and the first thing, as we went around the country and filmed with farmers of every type, the first thing that is said by people in commodity production is that, well, you can't feed the world with grass-based farms. And the truth is that we did feed the world up until 1950 with grass-based farms, with farms that didn't have agriculture. The year that we produced the most pork in America was 1911, but the caveat is that you have to have a lot more farmers. And so we did some calculations. And basically, if we wanted to produce all of the meat that Americans eat each year, we would need about 4 million people to start farming in a grass-based model. You know, you look at our current situation with the economy, you have the millennials born 1982 to 1990, and they're coming out of high school and college. They have the worst job market that we've seen since the Great Depression. You've got this rapidly expanding sustainable agriculture. Let's put a square peg in a square hole. Let's get these young people, able-bodied, idealistic, want to do work. Let's get them into these jobs in sustainable agriculture, and we can change our food system and revitalize rural communities.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. The numbers of people, you're saying you need 4 million new farmers. Of course, we've got a 10% unemployment rate. You just referred to that, and things don't look like they're going to turn around. On top of that, you have people in jobs now who hate what they're doing. They may have not liked it much, but now that they're working for, they're doing the jobs of 4 or 5 people who are laid off, they're hating it even more. And so the notion that you could get 4 million people into farming is not far-fetched. The other interesting thing is the amount of land it would take, and you show in the film that we have enough arable land.
Yeah, you would need 286 million acres of land, and we have well in excess of 1 billion acres of pasture and cropland, so it's absolutely doable. And to that point of people changing careers, we profile a number of people in our film who leave office jobs or leave cities and say, you know what, I'm not healthy, I'm not happy, I might have more dollar signs in my bank account, but I'd rather be healthy and happy and have less financially but more spiritually and health-wise.
But it ain't easy, and we'll talk more about that as my conversation continues with filmmaker Graham Merriweather, farmer Suzanne Nelson and Eliza McLean, and Jeff Barney, chef at the Saxapaw General Store and the Eddie Pub. Just ahead, a look at the economic forces that shape our current food system on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today about the documentary American Meat. It's a critique of our industrialized food system. It'll screen tomorrow night in Saxapahaw. My guests are filmmaker Graham Merriweather, farmer Suzanne Nelson and Eliza McLean, and Jeff Barney, chef at the Saxapahaw General Store in the Eddie Pub. Graham, one of the things you present in American Meat is this possibility of real change, something that is actually kind of new in the genre of food. Documentaries, the fact that it's possible. And one of the biggest proponents is Joel Salatin. He may be the most famous farmer in America, but let's listen to him from the film.
We have this idea in our country that in order to be economically sound, you have to sacrifice the environment. And I'm suggesting that the two can actually be synergistic, but what it requires is thinking 180 degrees outside of norm. I hope you're beginning to understand on the scale that we're doing things. There is no reason for a confinement house in the country, in the world, anywhere.
So let me ask you, Graham, what was your idea going into the film? What were you intending to make with American Meat?
Sure. We initially were going to do this film that was all about pioneers in the green movement. And Joel and Polyface was just jumping off of the screen with
That's the name of his farm.
Right, Polyface Farms in Swope, Virginia. Joel and Polyface was just jumping off the screen with charisma, and we realized that we needed to dedicate an entire film to the topic. So I spent most of 2007 on Polyface, and what we were doing, we were going to do something which is called a cinema verite film, which is where you don't use any voiceover, and we were just going to use the four seasons as the structure to the film. And so what happened was is there were times when Joel would talk about industrial agriculture, and so I sent an email to PETA, and I said, could you send us some stock footage of industrial farms? And they did, and I started to cut it over the images of what Joel was talking about with industrial agriculture, and something didn't feel right as a journalist. I was like, I've never been to those farms. I've never talked to those farmers. So I made a pledge, myself and editor and writer Memo, we said, we're not going to use any hidden camera footage in this film. So I spent the next 2 years going around the country and filming with commodity chicken farmers, hog farmers, cattle raisers, and it totally changed my perspective. I realized that this isn't something that's us versus them. This is something that, you know, if you're a chicken farmer raising for Pilgrim's Pride, you're doing what you need to make a living. You're doing what you need to keep your family farm going. And I'm very honored that one of the people in the film, Johnny Glosson, is going to be there on tomorrow night. He's a chicken farmer for Pilgrim's Pride here in Siler City. And actually, Jean, who's based in North Carolina, she's going to the woman that you ran the point at the beginning. She's going to be at the screening as well. So basically, I realized that it's not just about it's not just about bad and good. It's we all have to work together. We're facing so many challenges with our food system that we all have to work together to change this. And as far as making real change, we absolutely can. Polyface farms and farms like Suzanne's and Eliza's are cropping up all around this country. There is a real groundswell. There is a movement happening. I've been all across the country doing screenings, and you go to these towns and the farmers markets are swelling with people. They say we can't have enough vendors. Restaurants, chefs like Jeff, they're bringing this food in. We're going to change the system. It's just a question of time, and there's a lot of enthusiasm, and it's a great time to become a farmer as well.
And Eliza, you one of the farmers, the confinement farmers in Siler City, and you have – let's talk about that a little bit because, I mean, that's been part of the problem. For those who criticize industrial farming, confinement agriculture is about the worst. We don't like the way they treat the animals. They seem to be all penned in. They don't have much room, take off the beaks and all that. Loaded up with antibiotics because of the infections, and by the way, the meat doesn't taste that great. That's been the critique. But you have a relationship. Talk about that relationship you have and your perhaps more nuanced understanding of this kind of farming.
Well, I think in general, people like John Glosson, who I do know personally, they love what they do, and they believe in it. And I think I wasn't there, but when we did become more mechanistic, it took some convincing on everybody's part, but the farmers that did it believed in it. And when you look at Chuck Wirtz and you look at John Glosson in the film, I mean, they're by themselves. They're walking calmly through their animals. They're caring about what they're looking at. And I love that Graham brought out that human side because they are feeding America too. They are proud of what they do. They are farmers that don't make a lot of money. And they have respect for us in general. It reminds me a lot of like Duke and Carolina basketball. The fans are obnoxious, but the players actually are friends and they do clinics together. You know, I mean, we are all in this together.
And depending on the year, they all play good basketball, although not always. Well, Graham, let me talk a little bit about that. So in terms of the humanity, and that's something that you bring out in this film, that this is not an us versus them. But when it comes to the economics, that's pretty rough news for farmers just because of the structure of confinement farming. Who owns what and particularly who takes the greatest risk? Give us an outline.
Sure. I mean, one of the things that is when we looked at the macroscopic picture of our food system, it became very apparent that the only reason that our current system works is because of a lot of cheap oil. And so in 2008 was really a microcosm for what we can expect in the years to come. The price of oil went to $147 a barrel. That caused the price of feed to go up. That caused the price of meat production to go up. That caused Pilgrim's Pride, the largest producer of chicken in this country at that time, to declare bankruptcy. That caused Smithfield, the largest producer of pork in this country at that time, and today still, to contract by 20%. So, I mean, and this isn't news for people that are in the industry, for farmers. There's a reason why we're moving more towards this local distribution model. Part of it's ideology, but part of it's pragmatism. I mean, it makes more sense if you don't have to truck something 1,500 miles. It makes more sense to truck it 5 miles or 50 miles or whatever that lesser amount is. So the sustainable agriculture, I think probably the most convincing argument for it is the fact that the price of oil is going to continue to go up, that even by the most conservative estimates, by the year 2020, we'll be at $200, $300 a barrel. And at that point, even with $15 billion in subsidies, it's not going to work. So we're going to need alternative models. And that's where this movement is so exciting, because it's urgent and because it must happen.
And here's what happens to at least one farmer in your film when Pilgrim's Pride decides for those reasons, suddenly the price of oil goes up, and they say, well, you know what, we're going to cut back on our productions. Here's what happens.
It really makes me sad to come in here and see these empty houses, because I'm used to baby chicks being in here. This is one of the houses that I raised chickens in until October, and it's been sitting empty just like it is right now, ready for chicks, but so far I haven't got any promise of any chicks anytime soon. on this particular farm, I owe just a little bit over $420,000. It costs me $17,500 for every 2 months that these houses sit empty.
I mean, the fact is, in confinement agriculture, when it comes to chickens, the farmer bears all of the costs. So you spend all that money, you buy the house, you pay for the air conditioning, you put in the cooling system, you pay for everything, and what you are is a manager. So you get paid to raise the thing. Now, once you are millions of dollars in debt for this system that you buy, if that owner, Pilgrim's Pride, for instance, they're out of business, says, you know, we were going to pay you 25 cents, but now we're going to pay you $8. And you can quit if you want, but the bank isn't going to like it. That's the condition. That's the situation they find themselves in.
And they get trapped. I mean, and it's really sad to see, because they get on this treadmill of debt where, let's say in 1990, they get new chicken houses. They take out a $175,000 loan. By the time that 18 years later they've paid it off, suddenly it's obsolete technology, and they have to retrofit it. So they have to take out these loans again. They're making $18,000 a year. I mean, it's a situation where, you know, everyone talks about how bad it is for the animals with industrial agriculture. That bothers me a little bit, not that much. I care more about the farmers, because the farmers are getting squeezed from both sides by the big corporations. But then they're also walking through those confinement barns, breathing in that ammonia, breathing in the fecal particulate that's in the air. And it's a disgusting thing. And the farmers, we need to worry about the welfare of the farmers in this country. The farmers are so underappreciated, and, you know, commodity, grass-based, any type of farmers, we need to celebrate our farmers in this country, because let me tell you something, we have twice as many people in prison than we do farming. We have the average age of the U.S. farmer is 57. We cannot survive with that situation. So we need to inspire and celebrate a new generation of farmers.
But Suzanne, how do you do it? I mean, it seems to me that you're also vulnerable to market fluctuations. How is it different for you?
The level of infrastructure and capital to start is a totally different thing. I mean, for $100 and probably a lot less if you scraped materials, I can build a little broiler shelter. And that broiler shelter can hold 75 birds. And I move it twice a day. And all of a sudden, for very, very little money, I have portable infrastructure that was very low capital. And so the point of entry to the market is much, much lower. And plus, I have a lot more control over what the cost of the chicken is, because I'm direct marketing it. So, you know, everybody wants to be the middleman because the money's in the middle. Well, one of the ways that Eliza and others like us have done this is we became the middleman too, and we became the marketer. And so we are price setters rather than price takers.
Eliza?
And we're also letting our animals give back to the environment that's actually supporting them. It's a cyclical, truly sustainable situation. When you can follow her chickens with the sheep and the cows, and I'm rotating many species on my farm, and each and every one of them is such high quality that the consumer wants it. Once they get a hold of it, they don't really go back, it seems.
And you have to be innovative too. It seems to me you're not talking about walking around with a rock tied to a stick to do your farming. You've had to innovate, come up with new ideas to keep yourself in business, right?
Yes, but can you explain that? What do you do with the rock and the stick?
You would cultivate the ground.
Oh, okay.
You would bang a furrow.
Thank you.
I don't do a lot of farming, but you would make a furrow with that, and then you would plant your seed, and you would feed a hungry nation.
Thanks, Frank.
Okay. But you have innovated. I mean, so tell us some of the things that you've discovered as a farmer and, in a sense, pioneered to keep yourself in business.
Well, I think, and people like Joel have done this too, you find, especially when you're actually stopping for 3 seconds to show other people what you've done, is actually when you learn a lot about what you've done. And on my farm, I have working animals. We use a lot less petroleum than most farmers do, because the pigs are tilling the gardens for me. They're putting in the residue from years past. They are the fertility of that garden. I don't use synthetic fertilizer, pesticides, things like that. My goats are reaching under the, you know, fence lines to get all the things that I would need to weed whack, and the chickens are the sterilizers with regard to all the dung that's left by from all the other animals, and it just goes on and on. And you really create this incredibly healthy system that It's a little bit like that rat race. It's just not so financially constrained because I can't imagine getting out of it. What would I mean? All these things are in circulation and I've got them in place. So I need to keep adding as I'm pulling out too.
So. Yeah, and you just showed at Joel Salatin's farm, he's come up with these remarkably high-tech formulas for moving chickens around that have to do with little pieces of wood and corrugated aluminum, I think.
Yeah, he always has humorous names for his inventions, like the Piggerator and the Eggmobile. And to Suzanne's point, one of the things that when you become the middleman, it's really, first of all, Johnny Glosson, the commodity farmers, they get 8 cents of the dollar that people spend at the grocery store. When you are able to control every step of the process, you keep 100 cents on the dollar. And just as importantly, or maybe even more importantly, you can create jobs within your farm. Because if you have siblings or spouses or friends that want to be the marketer, that are more the outgoing type, they can create that job. And you look at Polyface Farms, they're pushing 20 full-time positions, and it's because they're every step along the way. And it creates jobs for the next generation, which is a huge problem with farming, is how do you attract that next generation to want to farm? And the way you do it is by making farming exciting and having farmers wear a lot of different hats and attracting potential jobs, which again are not out there right now, jobs for the family and for every different type of personality.
20 jobs in Swope, Virginia, population somewhere in the hundreds, and $2 million a year gross, right? So he makes a living. Suzanne, tell us a little bit, when we're talking about the future, how you got into this. You talked about being a journalist first. How did you become a farmer?
A couple of things happened in my personal life that turned my attention to food as a healing substance besides just, getting us along every day. And I had an investigative reporter's eye, and once I started paying attention to it, it became very difficult to eat what was even in very nice grocery stores because I knew too much about what it could be, and I no longer wanted to eat what was offered. I started with one cow named Greeley and 5 chickens, and I milled their feed in my home flour mill because I really wanted them to eat organic grains, and there weren't any available in North Carolina as livestock feed. And then I really fell in love with this notion that agriculture could be a regenerative rather than an extractive process. That I think all of us, even, growing up with a fairly green-minded mother, I still fundamentally viewed agriculture as something that we extract. We take. And to just turn around and look as a human being that my presence here and my eating on this planet could leave the soil better than I found it, that every year there could be more earthworms, that every year there could be more grass, that every year there could be more health. In the meantime, I'm gleaning food from this pasture and I'm feeding my friends and neighbors. I truly fell in love with that concept in a way that I can't remember ever loving any idea.
Jeff, how has the landscape changed for chefs, restaurateurs, in terms of just finding the kind of food that now seems to be growing in demand?
Well, it's still not easy, but the great thing about the local food shed movement is the real relationships that evolve. So I think we live in an economic climate where and we're seeing the unsustainable nature of that climate where you don't know who's producing what for whom and what you're getting. And so the relationships start to fasten and become sustainable themselves. To me, underlying this whole movement is the sustainability of human relationships. So through that, we've seen in the triangle and now starting in the triad, more and more folks doing it. So it is getting easier. Yeah. It is getting more available. Right now, I think what we're working on, particularly with Suzanne, is making it more affordable. We are very extensive in the local food offerings that we provide, and it costs us a lot. So we're making an investment in that going forward.
Well, then one of the ways we could address that, and I only have about 30 seconds left, Graham, but is in terms of federal policy and subsidies, and the Farm Bill is coming up for discussion.
Yeah, and one of the things that you can do if you're interested in supporting the Farm Bill is you can go to fooddemocracynow.org. They're great advocates on behalf of farmers everywhere. There's a great bill called the Beginning Farmers and Ranchers Act that's being put forth by the Young Farmers Coalition and the National Sustainable Agricultural Coalition. So those are things to definitely get behind, because we need to shift more money to get young people into farming.
Yeah, you know, and you said at the retail level, farmers, industrial, corporate farmers get about 8 cents on the dollar at the retail level. Big farmers, in terms of subsidies, get 62 cents of every dollar they get comes from the federal government, part of that $20 billion in subsidies. So part of the expense goes to that. And the farm bill, which is usually way off our radar, is something we ought to be paying attention to.
Yeah, and it's coming up, so we can do this.
Thanks so much for being with us. Eliza McLean, Cane Creek Farm, Suzanne Nelson, Cozy Farm, Chef Jeff Barney of Saxapaw General Store and the Eddie Pub, filmmaker Graham Merriweather. You can see his documentary American Meat Thursday night, 6:30, Haw River Ballroom in Saxapaw. A panel discussion with the filmmaker and a lot of farmers and food purveyors will follow. For more information about the event, hawriverballroom.com. Just ahead, how to read the Quran with a UNC professor, Carl Ernst. Stay tuned.